The Catholic Coffee House presents God Had Mercy on Me by Matt Simmons. This podcast is brought to you by the Diocese of Lincoln.
Thank you all very much. Get this out of the way. Hold on. I didn't think it was going to be awkward, and then I got behind it, and it's kind of awkward. No, I'm good. All right, let's say a prayer first. In the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Amen. Father, thank you for this opportunity to come together before you in your name. Please pour your Holy Spirit upon us. Please open our hearts to receive you in a new way. And please, Lord, draw us deeper into yourself. Please anoint my words, give me some words to speak, and let your will be done always. Amen. Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen. All right, so as Father said, my name is Matt Simmons, and I work here part-time with the Unbound Ministry, and I also started Sacred Heart Ministries about a year ago, and basically with that, I teach people to pray. I do one-on-one mentoring, spiritual guidance, and then I also give retreats and things like that. And so that's how I spend most of my time now. The whole title here, God Had Mercy on Me, I've been thinking about that a lot lately. And thinking about God's mercy. And a lot of times we think of that in the limited sense of God's forgiveness. But his mercy is actually so much broader than that and so much wider. Like the fact that every one of us is even here with all of our cells put together, that this moment happened right now is because of God's mercy. It's because of his grace, right? That's the only reason that any of us are sitting here today doing anything we're doing is his grace and his mercy. And so his mercy is all-encompassing. It's huge. It's not just forgiveness. It's also healing. It's also life. The ability to be in relationship with one another, in communion with him and one another, all of that is his mercy. And all of that is what I didn't have for the longest time in my life. I grew up here in Lincoln. I'm 38 years old. I grew up here in Lincoln. I went to high school right there at Southeast. And my upbringing was not real great. I wasn't raised Christian or anything like that. My mom had some faith. My grandparents and other family members were all Methodist. I don't know why. They all came from the Methodist Church. They all went to church and all that, but not a real sort of deep evangelical faith that I'm familiar with. I wasn't raised around that kind of stuff. I was raised by my dad primarily. My parents were together, married for 8 years before I came along. And then when I was three, after my mom had me, pardon me, she had postpartum depression. And that wound up morphing into mental illness that stayed with her until now. She's currently still has mental illness. And so she was bipolar, and she had schizophrenic tendencies in there too. And so her mental illness was pretty bad. And for the first few years after I was born, my family didn't know what was going on. My mom was just erratic, all kinds of problems, da 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 da. Well, when I was three, she decided she wanted a divorce from my dad. So my dad moved out. And when I was five, they wound up divorcing finally. And so I don't remember my family being together. I wasn't raised by two parents together. And I don't remember them together. I have a sister who's 7 years older than me. And she remembers my family together. And her experience and both of our experiences of our family are vastly different. Right? And so I grew up alone, feeling alone most of the time. Right? My parents did not get along whatsoever. They were at each other's throats all the time if they're around each other. My dad had a temper. Very good man, worked very hard. He had a rough time in his teenage years and wound up going to prison for a period of time. But that was back in the late 50s, early 60s, where you could actually get out and change your life around and make something of yourself. Today, that's not always a possibility. And so he did that. He got out and he moved to Lincoln and a family took him in. And he wound up going to university, got some education under his belt, wound up working for the Journal Star, and then ended at LES, both of which he worked, I think, 20 years apiece, somewhere around there. So he really turned his life around. And my dad had a lot of pain in his life growing up. His mother was an alcoholic and had multiple affairs on my grandfather. It was just a mess, right? And she left when he was about 14. And so this is what shaped my father's own anger with my mother, is watching his wife do the same thing to his son and his daughter, right? And so my dad was a very angry man. It was just boiling under the surface. At home, we'd kind of walk on eggshells around him. He wasn't physically abusive, nothing like that. But the verbal stuff and just the fear, you know, you just knew that you didn't move the wrong direction or do anything like that. And that's what life was like at home with my father. He loved me very much. He just had so much pain and stuff in his own life that it shaped how he lived his life, right? And like most men, most of us today, he just kind of compartmentalized all that stuff, said, I've dealt with it, put it aside, and just went to town and did his thing. And in my work today, that's one of the funniest things I hear, right? When I meet with people one-on-one frequently is, oh, I've dealt with that. Frequently, what that means is I put it in a box, I put a lid on it, and I've set it aside because I need to move on with my life, and this can't impact my life anymore. That's generally what it means. And so that's how I grew up, and that's exactly what I did, right? When I would encounter discomfort, when I would encounter pain, sadness, loneliness, isolation, anything like that, that's exactly what I would do. I would do anything I could to push it aside, to move on, and to get on with my life. Unfortunately, I wasn't really capable of doing that. I started drinking and smoking pot and doing other drugs at a pretty young age, about 12. That was when I first came onto it, right? And I was the kind of person who was not a functional drunk, not a functional person. There are many people in the world who drink all the time, do all that kind of stuff, and they still fulfill all their daily obligations, right? I was not that person. I was like a basket case most of the time. I had no clue how to take care of myself. I had no clue how to do any of that stuff. And like literally for me, a normal lunch would be a Snickers and a Mountain Dew. And it wasn't because I was some obnoxious kid who was just doing my thing. I really did not know what to do and how to take care of myself. I did not know this stuff. My dad really wasn't present. He spent most of his day working, and then at night he did taekwondo and those kind of things. So he was busy a lot and he really wasn't around. And so what this left in the void there was my sister to raise me. And my sister's 7 years older than me, and she was more like a mom to me most of my life than my sister, which can really twist and convolute that relationship because she was never supposed to be my mom, right? And so growing up, most of the time, like realistically, what teenage daughter wants to be spending her time running her kid brother around to events and to do things, right? They want to be hanging out with their friends, being a teenage girl, doing all kinds of stuff they want to do. And so it became across very clearly in her behavior to me that wasn't what she really wanted me doing. And I grew up feeling that she was angry at me a lot, right? And her own anger, her own turmoil that she came across in our family a lot of times came out on me. And it came out in kind of kicking me to the side, begrudgingly taking me to do things, just generally not being very nice and not being kind, patient, and loving. Those things that God asks of us. And so growing up was really uncomfortable, and I felt alone and isolated. You know, and in a what our family's supposed to be is our mother and father are supposed to make up the image of God for us. If you look throughout Scripture, God has both seemingly masculine attributes and feminine attributes, depending on where you're reading and what the context is, right? And so what it's supposed to be is our parents make up the image of God for us. In this perfect world, if we have perfect saintly parents, right, they raise us, we start out, and we rely on them. We learn that they're trustworthy. We learn that they're there to protect us. They're there to lead us, to guide us, to shape us, to mold us, to care for every facet of our lives. That every facet of our lives is important to them, right? In a perfectly holy family with parents, work for dad or mom these days, whatever it is going to be something that enriches the vocation of marriage, right? It's not something devoid of that. It's something that enriches it, builds it up, and builds the family. And that's not what it was for me. And so in a normal upbringing like this, we rely on our parents. And we have this visible reality before us to demonstrate love, to give us a lived experience of being loved, cared for, all of that. And as we grow up, when we hit that age, 18 to 22, whatever it is, in there, an age of maturity, we pass from our parents' hands into God's hands. And because we have experienced all of this in reality with our parents, we can trust in this invisible reality that we can't see, we can't touch, right? And the degree to which our home life or our parents made mistakes or weren't perfect, a lot of times is the degree to which our image of God is skewed, right? And so for me, I knew unequivocally growing up, my dad made plenty of money. We never had to worry about that. He wasn't rich, but we never had to worry about anything like that. So today, and always, I've never really had a problem trusting God about things like that, financial things. Now, my emotional life, on the other hand, that's a whole different ballgame. There's other aspects of my life that I've struggled with ever since becoming Catholic to entrust to God, right? That I've been stretched in many, many ways that are painful. And so growing up, I had this huge gap, right? And the thing is when we have our home life is not this image of God. There's a gap in this transition between our parents and God. And it's not a smooth transition. And so a lot of people have this gap, and it's not like we're going to get out of our parents' hands and go, whoop, I'm into God's hands. You know, there has to be something there to bridge that. And it can be experiences of God we have just in prayer, one-on-one with other people. But frequently in my own life, it was people who loved me in ways that I never encountered in my own family of origin. And they were the ones who filled that gap. They were the ones who drew me into the mystery of God's love. They were the ones who I could share my heart to and actually tell my stuff to. And they sat there with love in their eyes, listened to me, and accepted me anyway. And there have been many people in my life over the last 10 years that have done that for me. And really, those people were God's tools to bring me right where I'm at today. And so my plane was barely getting off the ground, right? Like I wasn't even in the air to be handed off into God's hands. And so growing up at home, once again, I felt very alone and isolated. My sister didn't like me. My dad didn't want me. My mom was so erratic and apparently didn't want me. She moved off to go party and do her thing in Omaha, which is where she went to. And that's kind of looking back now where my mind was at the time. I didn't know love. I didn't know attention, right? I remember the first time when I was in the crisis center, I had had a brush with suicide and made a very serious attempt. I slit my own throat. And I wound up in this place, and it was the first time I encountered a 12-step program. And it was the first time I sat in front of two people who just listened to me. They didn't want anything from me. They weren't trying to fix me. They weren't trying to help me. Right? They were just there, present, and they listened to me. And that was really the beginning of grace for me. Right? So all throughout my younger years, I mean, you can kind of tell what I did. I mean, I drank, I partied, I did everything I wasn't supposed to do. Right? And my dad, I remember growing up, there was this company, Massimo, that made t-shirts, and they had all sorts of funky stuff on them, and one of them said, "Bank a Dad." And I'll never forget that as long as I live. Because that was so indicative of what my relationship with my father became. He was my walking ATM machine. And that's really all he was there for. And see, growing up alone and isolated like this, what happened is I started to develop the ways that I needed to get through life. I wasn't taught the tools to get through life that many people are. And so I figured it out on my own. And my own way of figuring that out was not okay. Right? I used people. That's what I did. You were there for what you could do for me. Financially, if you're a woman, attention-wise, whatever. Drugs, alcohol, food, money, entertainment, I really didn't care. But if you brought something to my life, you were in it. When you stopped bringing something to my life, you were gone. And that's how I lived my life for a long time. And nobody wanted to be in my life eventually. Right? That's kind of what happens when you live that way. You ostracize people. You kick them out. They don't want to be used. Nobody wants to be used. Right? And so over the years, by the time I hit 18, I had done ruined my relationship with my father. He couldn't handle it anymore. He had gotten cancer. He'd gotten lung cancer. And I remember it was that Christmas Eve that we found out. And it was very shortly after that that he wound up cutting me off and cutting me out of his life because he was tired of being an ATM machine. He was tired of watching me waste myself away on meth, getting high all the time, wasting everything away. He was tired of it, right? And today I wouldn't do what he did if it was my own children, but I understand. I understand the pain he was in and his own inability to cope with it and deal with it. And that was the way he knew how to handle it. And so that's what he did. He wound up giving me the title to my car, last few boxes of stuff I had at his house, and some money that I conned him out of to buy more drugs. And he was like, okay, that's it. Here you go. He's like, if you get it back together, call me. Until then, don't bother. And so about a year later, he wound up in the hospital, and he was at Bryan Hospital. And I went up to see him, and I was sober that day, but I went up to see him, and he asked me to leave. He said he didn't want me there, right? And then the next time I heard from him was about 3 days before he died, when he was at the hospice unit at Tabitha. And I had gotten a call at a place I was staying and told he was there. And so that was on a Thursday night. And that Friday I went to Tabitha, and my sister and I hung out with him and were there. It was really awkward. And then Saturday I spent the whole day alone with him, which was good and awkward all at the same time. We spent a lot of time together talking, but we never reconciled anything. And the last thing I said, I love you, before I left. And he said, I don't believe you. And that was where everything was left with my dad. And when he said that to me, what I heard was, yes, you are a POS. That's what I've thought about myself all my life. I thought I was crap. I thought I was junk. I knew I destroyed people's lives. I destroyed my own life. I knew it. And here was the man, the person, the one person who was consistent in my life. Even if he wasn't all there all the time and wasn't the perfect dad, he was the one person who was consistent in my life, the one person whose opinion I truly cared about. And at that point, what I heard was him confirm everything I thought about myself. And that was a really difficult thing. And that was back in 1998. And it's probably taken me until the last couple years to finally really get on the other side of that wound and all that happened in that relationship. And so when that happened, I received a small inheritance very smartly. He gave most of it to my sister and left me with a little bit, which I promptly chewed up, drinking and drugging, and wasted everything away. And that's when I wound up trying to kill myself and wounding up in the mental hospital. And I was a mess. Like, I was 21 years old. I had lost my father. My mother and I hadn't talked for some time at this point, you know, probably a good 5 or 6 years that I couldn't talk to the woman. Growing up with her, I would go see her periodically in Omaha. And my mom went to charismatic evangelical churches that have a tendency to tell her, if your faith is strong enough, you won't need your medication. And so she would constantly be on this cycle of being on medication. Somebody would say something in that direction, or she would just want to be high on the mania, and she would get off, right? And her cycle was to get off, wind up on the streets, wind up in jail, wind up in a mental hospital, wind up medicated, and then it just kind of went like that. And it went for about 25 years. Well, on one of her deals, she locked my sister up in Richard Young Hospital in Omaha, and then locked herself up promptly right after that. And she hid me with some friends in Bellevue somewhere, something like that. And so it took my dad, I don't know, a week or two to find me. And then it took him a lot of attorneys to get my sister out of this hospital. And so there was a lot of damage there for my mom. I didn't trust her. You know, she was so erratic. And she was really never around, right? Just never present. And a mother is so important in the love she gives us. Like, since having kids, I finally realized, in learning more about theology of the body, our moms actually present us and reveal us to our father. Right? The first month or two, my babies don't clearly need me in a direct way. They want mom. Right? They don't want me. I got nothing to offer them. And so they want mom, and what she does is say, here, meet dad. Right? But we learn how to receive from our mothers. In those early years, looking in her eyes, her spending time with us, loving us, we receive this love. We learn how to receive love. Every one of us does. And for a man, when he learns how to receive love from his mom, he gets passed on to his dad, because now he knows how to receive love from his father, because his father's primary responsibility is to give love. It's to give. His body says that. It's to give. Right? And in learning how to receive love from a father, when we learn how to do that as men, we also learn how to give in that process. As our father is giving to us, we learn how to give in return. For a woman to receive love from mom, she's learning everything she needs to learn, because that's her primary role in life, is to receive. Her body says this, right? And so she receives from mom and then begins to receive from dad. And she learns what kind of love to receive, right? And makes her life choices based on that kind of love that she knows how to receive. And so this is all very important. And so here I am alone. I don't know how to receive love. I don't know how to do anything, you know. And I wind up in the situation, my dad's gone. Well, after that, my dad passed away. And I was in the crisis center. And I hadn't read a book since I was about sixth grade. And I read Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And no joke, the entire time I was in school, I think that's the only book I ever read. My entire 12 years in school. And I didn't read other than that. It wasn't that I couldn't read, I just didn't care. I was too busy doing other stuff. And shortly after this, I read a book by John Sanford. It was some, I don't know, some mystery novel, cop drama thing. And then I don't know what happened when I read that, but I started reading like incessantly. I had this hunger when I met these men who sat there and they listened to me and all that. I had this hunger that developed at that point. And I started to question, because my life was such a mess, a wasted mess. And I started to question these things. I started to read philosophy, which was really out there. I started reading Plato, a little bit of Aristotle, but I didn't really like him too well. Then I promptly got into like Sartre, Nietzsche, Camus, the existentialist, which if you're somebody like me who is angry, right, and pretty anti-God, that is terrible reading, absolutely terrible reading. Because all it did was reinforce my anger. It gave me intellectual reasons to not believe, right? When in reality, the reason I didn't believe is because of all the hurt and pain I had in my life and in my heart, right? And so I started to read this stuff, and I started to change a little bit. I started to go to this group. I started to do things to change my life a little bit, but I couldn't really get along past the God question. And it would come up when I'd interact with these people, but I just kind of pushed it aside because I didn't want to deal with it. But I couldn't stay clean. And I'd constantly go back, just in and out, in and out, in and out. And over the years of doing that, about a decade of doing that, I would unwind just a little bit further. And so it went from reading philosophy, and then I'm like, well, I really need to be spiritual, clearly, right? But no, not the God thing. And so I got into Buddhism and started doing that, trying to meditate and those kind of things. And what was funny about meditation is I've always struggled with fear and anxiety. And so I can wake up in the morning today still, and the spring is wound tight in the center of my chest, and I'm just like, ready to go. Please, wife, don't talk to me yet. Let me get out of the house. You know, I don't want to create any problems here. Like, that can happen to me easy. And so when I would meditate, do this mindfulness meditation and quieting myself down, my breathing, all these kind of things, it would take the edge off of all of that, which was very helpful. But once again, in the long term, I couldn't stay clean. Like, it just wasn't working. Not like these other people that I was seeing who would find a relationship with God and their life would change, you know? And for me, it wasn't working. And the interesting thing about Buddhism versus Christianity is a lot of things are very similar in the ascetic practice. But the difference is there, the answer to suffering is don't be attached to anything. I mean, essentially, like, don't care about anything and you'll be fine is really what it boils down to, a certain detachment, right? For Christianity, and so they have practices of detachment, to detach from things, and this emptying, right, of the attachment. And in Christianity, what it is we do similar things. We have similar ascetic practices, but we need an infilling. I must decrease and he must increase in me. And that's the movement of Christianity. And it's not I'm going to be unattached to anything, but the reality is we're all attached to something. We're all dependent beings. And the question is am I going to be attached to God or not? Right? That's the real question. Because I'm going to be attached to something. For me, it was the drugs, the drinking, the food, all the sensual stuff in my life. That's what I clung to. And the question is am I going to cling to God instead? Am I going to be one with him? And so as I went through that, I realized my life still wasn't changing. Like, I'm okay a little bit of the time, but I'm still not quite okay. And so eventually I wound up leaving for a while this group and really falling downhill pretty fast and pretty hard, and I got hooked on Oxycontin. And for anybody who doesn't know what that is, it's a painkiller that's basically pharmaceutical-grade heroin is what it is. And I got hooked on that, and I did it for quite a while, and I was doing a lot of it each day, and eventually I wound up quitting. And it was a really hard, it was very difficult. I went through a lot of physical withdrawals. And after that, for a little while, I had severe depression. It's not just the physical stuff with that, but the psychological, emotional is really bad. And so here I am, I've quit. I'm about a week and a half, 2 weeks out from quitting. I've gone through all the physical withdrawals, but I was just a mess. And literally all I could think about was either killing myself or using again. That was it. And so I went to another meeting again, and I really didn't want to go, but this was kind of it. Like, if something doesn't work here, I'm going to do it. Like, I'm going to do the gun thing, and I'm over. And it wasn't that I wanted to die, but I wanted the pain to end. And I'd been in pain so much for so long. Like, I just couldn't do it anymore. The pain, it just hurt, the loneliness, the isolation, the disconnection from other people, the inability to honestly share my heart with other people. And actually receive when they share their heart with me. Because maybe what they share is makes me uncomfortable. And I can't be in relationship with people. And that's kind of how it was. And I was just so alone, I wanted the pain to end. And so I went to this meeting that night and I left. I hated every minute of it. And I left and I was walking to my car and a buddy of mine caught me. A guy who I lived with once before. And we hadn't talked for a long time. He's like, hey, let's go talk. I'm like, are you serious? I'm tired of talking. So all we do is talk. I was so tired of it, seriously. I didn't want to talk to anybody anymore. Just tired of it. I was like, all right. And it was kind of a half get him off my butt type thing. And also, I really had no options, right? So I went and met him at Metal Art Coffee on South Street. And we sat down and talked. And he cornered me about how much of a mess my life was, right? Which I had already known. It was crystal clear to me. It had been clear to me for years my life was a mess. But that I couldn't manage my life anymore. That was always the clincher for me. And that's really the clincher for every single one of us, is can we give up management of our life? And for me, I managed every aspect of my life. There was no surrendered areas of my life. And I made a mess of it. And that was crystal clear. And the track I was going down was I was going to die at some point. I mean, this is inevitability. The way I lived my life, the way I was doing things, at some point it was going to escalate another step and it would be over. So he's like, well, the only thing that's going to do it is God. I'm like, oh, here we go again, you know? Like, all right, whatever. And so we're talking about stuff and he keeps telling me to surrender my life, surrender your life, surrender your life. And I've been hearing this for years now at this point. And what I figured out later is just like many people in this group, right? At some point, it's like, what the hell does that mean? Surrender your life, right? What does that mean? I get it. Sure. Here's my life. But what does it mean? And that was the struggle for me for the longest time. I didn't know what that meant. And this was the first time somebody sat down with me honestly and explained to me what that meant. And he said, Matt, there's going to be a cost to surrendering your life. He said, what you want to do from now on takes second place to what you should do. Or what God wants you to do. He says, simple as that. And so at the time, the example that was given to me as well, my now wife, Demetra, we were dating at the time, and she said, he said, well, and at the end of the night, you know, if you want to go home and cuddle and coo with Demetra and watch a movie and stuff, but there's this person over there puking on themselves because they can't get cleaned up, he's like, you need to go help them. That's what it means to surrender. It means every moment of every day looking to see how I can serve, not how I can take. So if my wife needs something, if she needs help in some way, if I see a need there, a surrendered life means that I pour into that need, right? If I see somebody, if I'm paying attention to other people outside of myself, because self-centeredness is really my problem, I'm that selfish, that I need to start focusing outward. And when I see need, I need to pour in it. And that's what I was taught to do right away, was when I see a need to pour into it. And that's what it means to be surrendered, right? And to pray every day, all those kind of things that we would all think of as surrendered life. But those were the things that really stuck out to me. It's like, all right, that all makes sense, you know? So he's like, oh, let's go outside and let's say this prayer. Let's surrender our lives to God, da, 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 da. And I'm like, okay. And so we went out into the loading dock area, right by where Open Harvest loads up all their stuff there. And it was really awkward because there was poetry that night. There's people everywhere. And he's like, let's hit our knees right in the middle here and pray this prayer. And I'm like, oh, my God. Really uncomfortable. And I figured everybody was watching me. I mean, the way I look, like I, at that time, I always thought everybody was watching me. And so we sit there and we pray, and nothing really happened. It wasn't like the clouds parted or anything. But when I got up from that, he went about his day. And I was sitting there and I was motivated to continue on with some other things beyond this and that program that I needed to do. And so I promptly got in my car and I got onto 16th Street and went up south to go to Walgreens to get a notebook and a pen so I could continue on with some things and do some journaling and writing. And as I was driving on South Street up there, now, mind you, before this, all I could think about was using or dying. And as I was driving up South Street, I realized God was thick as pudding in my car, and I had no desire to use, and I had no desire to die. He was just there. And ever since that day, I've never doubted the existence of God, never. And that was a pivotal point for me. My life did not get perfect after that at all, but that was a pivotal point where God broke in the darkness, just like what this Advent is all about. In my own darkened heart, he came. And for the longest time, I would ponder, well, why me? Why not that person? Da, 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 da. And I think about that sometimes with conversion. I think about this, and it's like the perfect storm. Have you ever seen that movie? Like they all converge at once, and it just it happens. And it's kind of like that with conversion, right? The perfect storm happens. A person is receptive, and they're open, and God's present and acting. And a lot of times, there's somebody else in the mix. Not always, but a lot of times. Which leads me to, it's never about me and Jesus alone. It's always me and Jesus within the context of community. Even if I was to come to faith with just my Bible in front of me, it would be me and Jesus within the context of community. Because it was the community that wrote that Bible. Maybe it was the Apostle Paul who accompanied me. Maybe it was Luke. Maybe it was Mark. Maybe it was Matthew. But it's never alone, right? And that moment changed things for me, and I ardently started on this path. I started moving on this path, and I was hooked, and I wanted God, and I wanted the truth, and I wanted it now. And that's really what I sought after. I'd experienced a presence and a love and a peace that I never experienced before in my life. And so I started seeking after it. I started helping people. I started serving people. I eventually wound up at Berean Church, because the group of guys that I fell into all went out there. And so I went out there. My cousin works there. He does all like the lighting and sound. And I'm good friends with Brian and Patty and all the head pastors, their family. I've tattooed all of his kids, which is kind of weird, and his wife. And so I got to know a lot of people out there, and that's kind of where I fell into church, was out there. You know, and I really didn't the only thing I knew for sure is I didn't like charismatics. That was the only thing I knew for sure. Beyond that, I had really had no experience with any other kind of Christian group. And I had a lot of baggage there. I didn't like Christians, quite frankly. I did not like Christians. And it honestly, when I look back, it wasn't that any Christians actually really did anything all that wrong to me. It really wasn't. But they weren't present very much in my life. And the ones who were present in my life always wanted to change me. I always felt like I wasn't quite where I needed to be, like I wasn't good enough, like I needed to be this way in order to be in their community. And I didn't experience that out there, right? And that's what drew me in out there. And I began to go there, and I began to go to church. They immediately saw that I was zealous for this stuff, and so immediately took an interest and started forming me. But one of the other things that I did that I've always done, and I don't know if it's my pride, if it's what it is, but I've never had a problem going to the top person and asking for help. That is one thing I've always done in this journey. If I see somebody who I think has the answer, I don't care if they've written 10 books or not. I don't care about that stuff. I want what they have because I want to change. I want to grow into this. I want to grow into this life in Christ, right? And that's something that I always suggest people do. People so frequently don't want to ask for help. They don't want to ask their pastor, or they don't want to ask the bishop, or they don't want to ask somebody else who seems like they're too busy for anything. Right? But ask. Ask and you shall receive. Knock. That's what Jesus tells us. Knock. Ask constantly. And that's what I did. And I started getting fed. Right? And they started teaching me about the Christian life. And I remember they gave me the book, The Case for Christ, and I was working in a tattoo shop at the time, and it was on a Sunday, and I went to work at noon. We closed at 10. Nobody came in the entire day, and I read the book that day, sitting in my boss's chair in the front of the shop, wondering if somebody was going to come in to deliver me from this book, right? Not that it was a bad book. I was just, it's very uncomfortable, right? And conversion is uncomfortable. Conversion is a suffering. We suffer our own conversions, because we receive this. We receive Jesus into our heart, and he displaces us. He displaces our self-centeredness, our ego, all these kind of things. And he changes us, and he changes things, and that's uncomfortable. And I really wanted to get away from that book because of that. Because they're going through there with the truth, routing out lies in my mind as to who Jesus is and why he couldn't be God and everything else. And by the time I was done, I had no intellectual reason that I could come up with as to why he wouldn't be God. I just couldn't. And so I went to the toilet about 10 p.m., kneeled over it, just like I'd done so many times before, and surrendered my life to God, to Jesus. Once again, no clouds parted, nothing huge happened. I just surrendered my life. And after that, I kept striving to live the Christian life, right? And so I'm with my wife at this point, now wife, we were dating at the time, and she was raised a cradle Catholic. And I didn't like Catholics. I had no reason not to like Catholics because I didn't know any of you. But I didn't like you. And I figured you were all a bunch of mindless sheep who just kind of followed what you were told to do. And, you know, that's kind of what I thought, you know. And I thought all the old typical stuff. Nuns whip you with rulers. There was just corporal punishment. I mean, that was my image of the church, okay, and Catholics. And so I was pretty anti-Catholic. And being out of Berean didn't help. Not that I was fed a bunch of anti-Catholic jargon, because I was not. However, the understanding was very much that we need conversion, and we don't have it, right? And so I didn't like Catholics. I was uncomfortable with the whole situation. My wife started going back to confession about the time we met and about the time we were going to Berean. She refused to go with me to Berean. She had been there a few times before, and she just didn't like it. And finally, we got into a fight one night, and I'm like, look, you're either going to become to Berean with me and follow me, or we're done. Like, this isn't going to work. You need to leave the church. Like, come to your senses. Let's go. And she wouldn't budge. And she couldn't defend her faith to save her life. She knew nothing about her faith, right? Nothing. But she would not move. She would not budge. And that was new for me. I always had been able to manipulate people and get them to do what I want. Press on them with anger, with fear, anything I could to get what I wanted from people, but she would not budge over this. And that had never happened with a woman before. And that struck me. And I left, and a couple days I thought about it, prayed about it, and finally came to the conclusion Jesus probably wouldn't act like I did. So I might need to go back and at least apologize, right? And kind of see what's up from there. And so I did. I went and apologized, and Next thing you know, I'm calling her priest, making an appointment to go talk to him to find out what's up there. Right? And not because I was overly interested, because I wanted to become Catholic or anything, but I realized I had never actually talked to anybody about it. I didn't know what the church taught. I didn't know anything about it. And so I went and talked to a priest, and he was perfect for me. You know, God has all the right people and everything just in the right spots for us to be here. And that man was perfect for me. Anybody who knows him knows that he walks the line of appropriate a lot of times and dances on that, right? Padre Johnson out of St. John's. I love the man. But he does, and for me, that was what I needed. I didn't need somebody to whip me over the head with a catechism. Not what I needed. And there are people that do that. But what he did when I met with him is I had no idea that there were schools and rectories. I knew nothing of that. And so when I went up there, I walked into the school. And it was, I don't know, mid-afternoon, mid-morning, something like that. It was when school was on. And my wife is a teacher with LPS. And they have, like, tables like this sitting there with people in security fine-tooth combing everybody who comes in. And so I was freaked out walking into that because looking like I do, I'm not always received terribly well, right? And at that point, I definitely had a chip on my shoulder still. A lot of the rough edges hadn't been worn off. I wasn't at peace most of the time. I was agitated most of the time. And so I walked in there, and the lady walked out of the office. She's like, hey, how's it going? What can I do for you? How can I help you? Da, 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 da. And what struck me is she treated me just like she would anybody else. Right, and sent me up to the rectory. I went up there, and I met with Father, and he's walking around doing stuff. And he's like, so where were you baptized? Da, da, da. And I was like, oh, I'm not Catholic. And he just stopped. And he was like, aren't you afraid you're going to go to hell talking to me? I was like, what? I was like, who is this dude? Like, he's weird, you know? And so I sat with him for an hour, hour and a half, and we talked. And he was amazing. You know, I had very barbed questions for him. I didn't ask questions in a nice way. I threw them out there, and they were darts and daggers coming at him. He never broke. He was always just kind, joked with me, laughed with me, would answer my questions, ignore my crap, and just kind of work with me. And that was my beginning with the Catholic Church. And so I started meeting with him regularly and talking to him more because he was somebody I could talk to. He was like a father figure to me. Right, and I remember the first time I went to Mass there. It was a midnight Mass, Christmas Eve, and it would have been 2006, I think. And I just cried like a baby the whole time I was there. At the time, I didn't know why, other than there's this guy who kind of looks like my dad, about my dad's age, all that kind of stuff. There's the father thing going on here. But I didn't really know why, right? And what it was Jesus. He's right there. I was with Jesus. The answer to all my pain was sitting there with me, just being there with me. And I was being healed in that time. And I didn't even realize it at the time. Those were tears of healing. And what I didn't realize now looking back is I'd come home. I'd found my home at that point. I didn't know it at the time. And so I left that, and I continued going to Berean. My wife was at Wesleyan at the time at school, and they were going on a mission trip to India, and they were going to work with Tibetan refugees. And it was like a poli-sci mission trip. And so I was going to go over there with her because it was dirt cheap, and it was probably going to be the only opportunity I ever have to go to India. And quite frankly, I was a jealous person at the time, so I went with her. Number of reasons there. And before I left, or before we went, Father was like, well, when you're over there, you should look up Mother Teresa's sisters, if you can. And I'd heard the name Mother Teresa, but I knew nothing else about her. Nothing. And so I started researching her, looking into her and her writings and things like that. And I became borderline obsessed with Mother Teresa because she was speaking to me. She was speaking to the lost, the lonely, the unwanted, the unloved, which is what she called the poverty of the West. Over there, it's easy to fix. Plate of food, beans, rice, whatever it is. But over here, I mean, the situation we're in, I had every opportunity I ever wanted. My dad wanted me to go to college. He paid for my first semester to go, and I'm the one who came back and said, save your money. Not worth it. Here I am. I have every opportunity that anybody could have, and I'm killing myself. And that's what we do. We're rich beyond compare. We don't know poverty here in America, right? And yet we're eating ourselves to death. We're killing ourselves, drugging, drinking, porn. I mean, you name it, all the stuff that's out there today. You know, people in Asia get irritated. I was reading an article recently of factory workers get irritated because of all the crap they make for us to buy. They're like, what are you doing over there? That was really interesting to me. I'd never thought about that before, right? But over here, that's what it is. I had all these opportunities. I had everything, but here I am dying, wanting to kill myself. There's something severely wrong with that, right? And that's what she talked about, the Western poverty, and that really drew me in. And so we went over there, and we wound up at the Missionaries of Charity. I think it was the third week we were over there. It was right towards the end. And that became like my sole mission over there, is I wanted to see the sisters. That's where I wanted to go. And so Bob, the professor, let us go and let Demetra and I separate from the group and go to the mother house and try to set up a day to volunteer. And that was a total act of God, because we got there on a Thursday, which was their own day of recollection, where they shut everyone out. They just do stuff at home. They hang out together, clean, do all their stuff, have community time. And this little kid, we never would have found the doors to the place, because they were like in an alley. And there's like this bronze plaque at second story up with a sign. We never would have noticed it. It's so chaotic over there. And so this little kid takes us, like, I'll take you there. I'll take you there. So he takes us. Well, the sisters are shutting the doors just as we walk up. And this little kid walks up and just goes and blows the doors open. And I'm like, oh, my God. They're going to whip us with rulers. We're in India. We're not even in America. Like, this is a problem, you know. And I was really freaked out. And the sisters were so sweet. They were so nice. They invited us in. Like, oh, yeah, we'll talk to you just a few minutes. Go over to Mother's Tomb. Go pray over there for a little bit. We'll come and get you. You know, so we went over to Mother's Tomb. We prayed there for a while. And they came and got us, and they set us up to volunteer the next day. Typically, I didn't know this until we came back. You have to notify them in advance. If you're one person, they may let you do that, but they generally don't let you do that with a group at all. They want to know in advance. They want people to be prepped as to what they're going to do, da 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 da. So we got in to do it, and we wound up at this place called Premdon, which was not the home for the dying. It's for people to get taken in, and they usually get better and go back out on the streets. And so what we did when we went in there is we wound up doing a lot of different things. We cleaned mats. We massaged people because they don't ever get touched, right? And so they'd have these, you know, the food service, nylon food service gloves that do not fit correctly? Like on the wrist, they're really big and awkward. Well, they reuse those and vegetable oil, and that's what they would rub like on their joints, their legs, their arms, stuff like that. So that was kind of a new experience, not something I would do here very often. But I was talking to this guy, and one of the biggest things that impressed me is as I was talking to this man, he spoke English, and the priests and the nuns had taught him English. And he was talking to me about his legs, and his legs were healed really off, and his top, I think it like jutted out to the side a little bit and had a ledge, and it was just not okay. And he was crystal clear that he was in a lot of pain when he walked all the time. And so they call chow, and so we leave these people to go get food ready, to go serve everybody. Well, I go get plates, and I'm starting to hand them out, and I look over, and here's this guy who's in pain walking, helping somebody else to the bathroom who can't walk, who's less fortunate than him. And that was the first time that I'd seen that in Christian community. Like, I'd learned a lot about the faith. I'd been taught a lot, but I had never seen anything like that. The only place I'd seen something like that was in this other group that I attended, which had no affiliation to Christianity. And so that was huge for me. And then later on, we wound up cleaning the mats. And when I came back from India, all I could tell you was I saw God when I was over there. That's all I could tell you. I saw Jesus. And I was a mess. I was completely undone when I came home. Well, looking back over the years now, God has kind of shown me where he was at in many ways. And what happened was, is as we were cleaning mats, there was one other guy and me. Neither one of us were Catholic at the time. And so we're wiping down these mats, and there was one mat that had a guy on it who was almost dead. He was like feather light, bones, skin and bones. Looked a lot like my dad did right before he passed away from cancer. And so he's laying there, and I go up to sister. I'm like, well, what should we do about that? And she's like, oh, just pick him up, move him to the other one, put him back. I'm like, what? Like, I'm not a nurse. I don't do that kind of stuff. She's like, oh, just do it. Come on, come on. It's like, okay. So we get him, we pick him up, and Scott's on one side, I'm on the other side, and we pick him up, and he moves, and he kind of loses grip, the other guy does, and I wind up holding this guy. And that's where everything changed. Because it was just like what Mother said, I was holding Jesus in my arms, in the distressing disguise of the poor, and I was holding him in my arms. And everything he was on the outside, I was on the inside. He was dying. I was dying. I'd surrendered my life to Jesus, by the way. Right? I was trying to live for Jesus, but I was still dying inside. I still had a lot of unrest. I still had a lot of loneliness, emptiness, sadness. But this is where he entered in. And it was a cataclysmic event for me. I call it a Holy Spirit Hiroshima. Right? Because it totally wrecked everything in me. In spiritual direction, when I did the spiritual exercise of St. Ignatius, one of the things that came up was our heart is a garden, right? It is the Garden of Eden for us. That's where we dwell with God. We walk with him. We sit with him in intimacy, face to face, is in our hearts. And a lot of us have weeds overgrown in our hearts. Maybe we have parking lots that we built. Maybe we have some buildings and things like that. For me, I had a city in my heart. And what happened that day was it all got blown apart. And so what I left Calcutta with was this mess in my heart of rubble and rubbish. And there's kind of two ways God has a tendency to work on us. It can be like that in sort of burning bush experiences, or it can be more slowly and piecemeal and educationally, right? A lot of people that I work with and that I encounter on a regular basis, he hasn't gone in and just blown a building down. He's wanting to take it apart piece by piece, right? And so for me, that happened to be the way he worked with me. It all got blown up. And when I came home, I was a total mess. I really was a mess. And I cried every day for about 3 years. And I had no idea why. I didn't know. I thought I was going crazy like my mom. I thought I might have mental illness. The few people I actually told about that thought I might too. Because it's not normal, right? We don't cry every day usually. And what it took me a long time to realize is that I was healing. Pain, hurt, all those little boxes of hurt that I had that I had stuck there, those all got blown open right along with everything else. And it was all there. And I had a handful of years that were very, very difficult in my conversion. And this is something I usually don't talk a whole lot about, is what's happened after that. The last thing I want is for somebody to receive the message that I had a conversion and my life became perfect. And that everything just got worked out and everything was right. Because that's not what happened at all. As a matter of fact, I went to confession yesterday. And one of the things I was talking about to the priest was that there's times where I feel like a serious hypocrite. I have to go speak tomorrow night and tell my story. And here I am talking to you again about this. Right? Life's not perfect, and it wasn't perfect after that. The first 3 years were very, very difficult. My wife and I didn't start out right. We didn't start out like we were supposed to. We lived together from the get-go. Neither one of us were practicing Catholics, anything like that. We started out living together. About 2.5 years later, I wound up moving out eventually because I knew there was bad tendencies. And one of the things I got to learn through that process was why we don't cohabitate prior to marriage. The grace of the sacrament is not there to bind two people together, to really join them together as husband and wife, to be as Christ is to the church. I was not have the grace to pour into my girlfriend because she wasn't my wife. She did not have the grace to receive my love. Not in the way she does now as my wife in the sacrament. But we had to unwind a lot of that stuff, and that was very difficult and very painful. I had to get an annulment. I had been married once before. When I slit my throat, it was in front of a woman who later married me, to tell you how sick she was. Right? So I had to get an annulment. So this was all in the mix here, too. I had to get an annulment, and that's not a fun process. I've been listening to a lot of the stuff, you know, this whole, you know, the sins of the family and all this kind of stuff and the changes we made in the annulment process. And that was uncomfortable, man. It was really uncomfortable. It was like going to court. I've been to court before, and that's just what it was like. It wasn't a terribly pastoral thing, you know. It just, it was uncomfortable, you know, and I had to look at a lot of things in my life that I didn't want to look at that were really uncomfortable. And so I had a few years of really intense pain there. And eventually I got into spiritual direction. Happened to be the exorcist of our diocese, thank God. And I got into direction with him, and that wound up changing things for me. I had been with non-Catholic spiritual directors prior to that and had gotten so far. But once I got into that, that's where things really started to change. That's where I began to find some healing. I began to find a place and an explanation for everything I was going through. That this was all a normal part of conversion. That whatever pain we have prior to conversion, reversion, relationship, prior to looking at it, is going to come out. C.S. Lewis told a story, and I think it was Mere Christianity, about a little boy who's got a toothache, and he doesn't want to go tell mom, right? And he doesn't want to go tell mom because he knows what's going to happen is she's going to take him to the dentist, and then the dentist is going to root around his entire mouth, and he's going to find everything that's wrong, and he's going to want to fix it. And the kid's like, no thanks, right? That's what happened to me. When I came to God, I came to him for a purpose, and that was because I wanted to get rid of drugs and alcohol from my life. I wanted to be able to have a semi-normal life. I was not prepared for everything he wanted to root out of me, because there's a lot there. And every time a layer comes off, there's a more fragrant one below it. That one comes off, there's another one there. There's another one there. It just keeps going, going, going. And so I've had a lot of people walk with me along the way through this process of healing. I went to Focus for a couple years, which was the last place I wanted to go, to be honest with you. Most of the people there didn't have the same type of life experience that I did. They came from very different backgrounds, very different situations, a lot of them. Most of them were about 10 years younger than me, who were my peers in work. It was just a very uncomfortable time. But it was one of the most healing times that I ever had. It was like purgatory, right? And I hope it might take some time off at the end. But it was really uncomfortable because I was this guy who was so rough and barbed. I mean, I was so freaked out to go because every other word out of my mouth from being in a tattoo shop for so many years was an F-bomb. I'm like, how am I going to make it in Focus? Yeah, right, you know? So much healing occurred in that process. I got to be around people, and this is really the most important thing, I think. When I think about the church, is the church is so diverse. The people here are so diverse. There's people like me who have just had a mess of a life. And there are people here, probably somebody in this room, who's had a very, very good life. And is very healthy, and is very whole, and is very spiritually well. And we need each other. That's the thing that I learned throughout this whole process, is we need each other. I needed people who knew how to live life to be around, because I had no clue. And I learned a lot about how to live life. My wife and I got married 4 months before I joined Focus. So our married life for 2 years started out in that community, which was such a blessing. Right, our first baby came in that context when I was on the team at Focus, which was such a blessing as well. Because I remember when she was pregnant with Thaddeus, I was torn inside. Part of me was excited, but the way I lived my life before, like, that's a problem. You know, that's a bad night out, and you need to go get that taken care of. That's what a baby is. And so I was really torn. And I remember going down to the lower JP2 hall in the old Newman Center to tell them that we were having a baby. And they're like all jumping up and down about ready to pee themselves. They're so excited, you know? And I'm like, yeah, that's great. You know, I was just so conflicted. And what it was is I did not know how to be happy. I didn't know how to receive gifts. I didn't know how to receive grace and receive love. I didn't know how to do all that. And so these people there taught me how to do that. And so by the time my second child came, I'm like excited, super excited, bubbling over, telling them. I'm jumping up and down damn near peeing myself, you know, right along with them. But these are the things that the community has given me, right? These are things that I've had to learn in my time here, being amidst you guys. And what I also see with so many people who haven't necessarily experienced everything I've experienced is you all need us to serve us, to pull us in, to draw us in, to teach us how to live, to teach us how to grow to maturity. We need you, and you guys need us. Sometimes it can be difficult when people who haven't experienced things to interact with other people, you know, who have. Like, we have social circles. We have all these little circles in our life of people, and we don't always interact with each other, you know. But the Christian community, to really image God, is this constant selfless giving one to the other. Right? And so people like me who are coming into the church are an opportunity, a beautiful opportunity for people who are already here to receive Jesus in a new way, to touch Jesus in a new way in this distressing disguise of the poor. And I am indebted to the people who looked upon me that way and who continue to look upon me that way. The priest yesterday who continued to look upon me that way and said, yeah, I know, Matt, we all kind of feel that way. You know, meaning the priests, because they're always getting out their sinners too, just like the rest of us, you know. And so this conversion has been amazing, but it hasn't been without its struggles. And every day I'm always asked by Jesus to open my heart to him in a deeper way in vulnerability, to relate in deeper and deeper ways what's happening in me. And in the end, that's where my spiritual life is simplified down to. John 5:19, I only do what I see the Father doing. That's my examination of conscience today. And that's such a beautiful thing. I only do what I see the Father doing. When I read that, I had to start asking, do I know what the Father is doing? Do I see what the Father is doing? Do I have any clue? Because Jesus said he only does what he sees the Father doing. That's it. Right? And that's the kind of intimacy and depth of communion that I'm called to live with the Lord. And this process of allowing things to come up and allowing him to enter into that is exactly what has drawn me into that relationship. And so today my life looks very, very different than it once did. You know, I'm no longer puking on myself and all that. You know, I'm no longer, I can hold a job today, thankfully. I've had enough things healed in me that I can get along with most people. You know, there's people in the community who respect me. That baffles me. Like, I'm not kidding, that baffles me. That there's people who ask me to do this stuff. There's people who want me around. I have a wife who actually wants me there. I have children who look at me with the deepest, most innocent love. And there's not one other person who can impact their lives the way I can. And what a blessing. Something I do not deserve. My life was not on the trajectory to receive all the blessings I've received. Not at all. But that's who God is. And I think the one thing that I want people to know more than anything, in the Protestant world, legalism is a word everybody understands. It's not something we tend to understand here as much. We don't have to get our crap together to come to God. It's him coming to us that inspires us, draws us, empowers us, and enables us to get our crap together. It's all grace. It's all free grace. It's all his invitation. The church teaches that any desire for God, anything for God, any movement for him is already his grace and his action on us or in us. It's not of us. And so now in my work, on a day-to-day basis, I get to help people appropriate this into their interior lives, right? And to receive God. That's the main point of my work, is to help people receive Jesus. Pope Benedict XVI said that prayer is pure receptivity to God's grace. And the two movements of Christianity are receiving Jesus and then manifesting him to the world. That's the two movements of Christianity. And that's really today where my life stays, is right there. I try to keep it there. When I don't, that's when I veer off, right? I wind up in confession. But when I stay in that spot of trying to receive Jesus, to truly open my heart to him in vulnerability, I receive him. And what's changed in me so much is that I think about things a lot more godly. I look at people. There's times where I look at somebody or a situation, and it's clearly God looking at them, thinking about them this way. It's not me. Because like 2 hours earlier, I was just like judging somebody like this to my wife or something. You know, like that's how God works with me. He shows me these things very clearly in my own behavior. That's also how he convicts me of those things. It's not this heinous, harsh, throw lightning bolts at me. It's this gentle revelation of my fault and an invitation to come along in a new way. And learning that, learning how gentle and caring and loving God is, has been such an important part of my own road of healing. To realize I'm a son of God. My identity today is just that. I'm a son of God. I'm a beloved son of God. And I'll never forget the confession I went to at the Benedictine Monastery in Schuyler, where the priest said that to me. Do you realize when you were baptized, Jesus said, "This is my beloved son with whom I'm well pleased"? But that's what the Father said. I'll never forget that, because that's who I am today. And the more I strive to live from that, the closer I grow to that likeness. The more I open my heart in vulnerability to him, the more I open my heart in vulnerability to my wife. That's a whole new thing, right? When we got married, I had no clue. I'm like, how are we going to do this? We come from single parent homes. Like, no, this isn't going to happen. But many people have accompanied us along the way, and God has been there to teach us how to give and love and receive love one to the other, you know? And life is good today. And one of the most beautiful things is, even in the midst of whatever it is that we go through, the good, the bad, everything, God is always present in that. And I know suffering today, for me, is an opportunity to draw near to him. That's all it is. It's not God doing anything to me. It's an opportunity for me to receive Jesus in a new way. You know, and for that, I'm grateful. So thank you all for having me tonight. So the question is I had said that my encounters with Christians, most of them had wanted to help me, but then the guy who did help me, who led me to surrender my life, what was the difference? A lot of times what I experienced, and I think a lot of good intentioned people who want to help, we don't always look at the person because of their, like, just because of their, who they are. I want them to be loved because they deserve it. A lot of times there's something behind that, which isn't bad necessarily. Like, I want this person to have a good life. I want them to be a healthy member of society, all those kind of things. And a lot of times that's what I experienced. It was like I was a cog in the machine for this well-oiled, greased world and life and society we have. Not that I was this person who was hurting, who was in pain, and who needed that to be gone. I mean, it's a really simple thing. I don't know the answer to how a person changes that. You know, it's just the way it was conveyed to me through that man, you know. And I think that really gets into something is when it comes to evangelization, like in our country, business has influenced everything, right? Efficiency, productivity, how quickly, boom, 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 we can get her done, da-da-da-da. That phrase, get her done, it may annoy half the people in this room. It annoys me to no end. But I don't think there's any person in this room who can't relate to it at some level. Because it's such an ingrained part of American culture. Right? And so a lot of times we miss what's in between point A and point Z. And it's not an intentional thing. It's just the way we are, the way we think. We don't always necessarily see the simplicity of what's standing before us. No, we see another end goal, right? And so what I've encountered and the people who've really helped me are the ones who've looked at me and seen me, and I know they see me, right? How to change that, I have no clue. Anybody else? That's a long question.
Other than
the Eucharist. That's why I came to the church. It's the Eucharist. Once I realized that was Jesus. And what happened was, is I went to school at Berean. They had a Christian Leadership College for a period of time. And I was going to RCIA and the Christian Leadership College at the same time. I didn't understand the differences between evangelical Christianity and Catholicism. I didn't understand it. And so I was there, and we had a class. It was called a small church class. And the end final project was a church plant project. So we had to, like, kind of look at a community, look at who was there, so on and so forth, figure out how we'd do it, blah, 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 blah. Well, part of preparation for that was we had to form a biblically based position on baptism and Eucharist, because those were the only two, at least pseudo-sacraments, that are in the scriptures directly and clearly. And so we had to form a biblically based position on that. But first, we had to compare and contrast the Roman Catholic church structure and the Berean church structure, which was so fitting. And so that was the first thing I did. And when I looked at that, I begrudgingly gave that over to the Catholics. Because what I saw in the Catholic Church was a kingdom, a theocracy. And what I saw over here was a corporation, a business. It had its board of directors, its CEO, all of its department heads, and everything else underneath that. Now, a little background. I used to be terribly, terribly, terribly liberal. And like part of the Green Party, all those kind of things. But I've always had an issue with really big business. That's always been an issue of mine. And so when I saw these two things, this one was a kingdom, and that really stuck out to me, clearly. But when I started looking at baptism and Eucharist, the Eucharist was the one who did it, that did it. Baptism was really easy. But the Eucharist, that was the one that I wrestled with. And I prayed with those passages, John 6 in particular, for a long time, and Paul in Corinthians, where he talks about sinning against the body and blood. And a question I had is, well, how can you sin against the body and blood if it's not God? Like, or profane it, you know, there's something there I couldn't explain. But John 6 was what really did it for me. And I spent a lot of time, and a little backstory on that. So when I came back from Calcutta, I started going to Mass every day. Every morning I went to Mass. I didn't go to communion, but I went to Mass every morning. And Father Johnson, as I met with him, he gave me the brown volume of his breviary. He had just gotten a new set. He gave me that one. He's like, oh, go learn to pray this. This is what the sisters prayed over there. It'll be good for you. And so I was self-employed, and I learned how to pray the breviary, and I started praying most of the hours every day. And then he suggested I go to the Pink Sisters and go pray there. And I think his intention was, it's a little quieter there. You know, you may not need to sit through Mass. You can just go there and pray. Because I told him the reason I went to Mass every day is because my mind was slowed down. I had a semblance of peace there because Jesus was there. I didn't know at the time, but that's why. And so I started doing all three of those things. And I was doing those things for months before I did this study on John 6 and at Berean. And so one morning, I don't know what happened, but I woke up and I knew that was Jesus. It was just clear. I just woke up. I knew it was Jesus. And I promptly freaked out. I seriously freaked out. Like, I got really upset. And I didn't have a car at the time, so I walked to church from 53rd and Layton up to St. John's, 76th and Vine. Luckily, Father Bernardo was there, and he calmed me down, because I'm like, ah, what do? I can't be Protestant anymore. I got to be Catholic. Ah, I'm totally freaked out. And he's like, just calm down, man. Like, just relax. Like, once you hit the end of the semester, you know, if you think it's the right thing to do, probably is, go ahead and quit school there and just relax, you know. And I was really grateful for that. But that's, in the end, how I wound up coming, was it was the Eucharist. You know, Jesus really was pulling me in through that the whole way.
Talking about get or done, and related to your finding your identity as a son of God, and what sort of advice would you give to people who maybe feel like who I am is what I do, what I produce, my job, the things that I do, as opposed to who I am and who God created me to be? What sort of advice would you give to people kind of on that journey?
Oh. I think a couple things. One, begin to pray. Really pray. And pray with the scriptures. Really start to pray with the scriptures. Chew on the scriptures and let them change you. That's first and foremost. But then I would also suggest finding some solid books on the topic, because there's plenty of literature out there. There's plenty of stuff out there. Because part of the, particularly in the initial stage of conversion, we have to receive a Catholic mind. Our mind has to be flushed out of all the crap that's in there. And quite frankly, from our secular world, we receive a lot of it. And all that stuff needs to be unwound. And we really need to receive the mind of the church. So a lot of meditation, chewing on things in prayer, reading. But then talking to somebody. We should all be discipled, accompanied. We should be accompanied by somebody. You know, Christianity was initially called the way. The way. Because it's a way of life. It's a way of being. Right? It's a way of being in relationship with God and others in the world. And that gets imparted through other people who are walking this way, other people who know our hearts, who we reveal our hearts to. Maybe that's spiritual direction. Maybe that's pastoral care. Maybe it's a spiritual friend. But there should always be people in our life who are walking with us. So on the day-to-day, when they hear us speaking from those lies, that it's based on my production, it's based on my effort and all those kind of things, they can clearly and gently speak the truth into that immediately. Because see, that's what I had a lot of in the initial years, was people speaking the truth into all the lies that were filling my head. And that was so important. You know, the truth is what really uproots that stuff. So those would be the things that I would suggest. Yeah.
I'm a teacher, and I guess while you're talking, especially about your childhood, it kind of breaks my heart just knowing that there are kids who are in those such difficult situations. I guess, do you have any advice or thoughts on how I could help those?
I had two teachers growing up who I really loved. My fifth and sixth grade homeroom teacher, Mrs. Mines, I don't even know if she's still around. She was old at the time. And then Mr. Storr in seventh or eighth grade, who is my history teacher. The difference between those two teachers out of anybody else, they just treated me like a person. Really. They were just there, and they treated me like a person. I didn't get treated like a stupid little kid. And this is something I realize having my own children, is like they're people. You know? No, I mean, we all know that, but they're people. They're their own little autonomous cosmos of thoughts, feelings, desires, personality traits, all these kinds of things. And with adults, like my wife and I talk about this sometimes. We're like, I would never say that to an adult. And not because they're not my child, because I just would never even fathom correcting an adult that way. Right? But for some reason, it seems okay for me to correct a child that way. Or to speak to a child that way because they're small and seemingly insignificant, right? And so what these two teachers really did is they never treated me like that. I was just another person. And I don't know if they just had a really good sense of self and persons and things like that or what. But those were my primary encounters as a child with people who treated me that way. You know, and that was the greatest thing they could do for me, is just be there and be present and be real and treat me like a person. Anybody else? All right.